This podcast contains information, theories, and speculation based on the A Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin. It can and will spoil future episodes of the HBO television series Game of Thrones. This is your one and only spoiler warning. If you're looking for our non-spoiler podcast on Game of Thrones, please look at our feed archive for Sunday night and Tuesday afternoon releases, or visit baldmove.com for our entire catalog. Hey everybody, welcome back to the spoiler edition of the Game of Thrones podcast brought to you by Bald Move. You can find all of our content at baldmove.com. Of course, this is for episode 504, Sons of Harpies. Man, as a book reader, it really pained me to see Sir Barristan Selmy go out like that. I think it was a fairly fitting end to... is such a great character, is fairly badass. He had to die with his boots on. But on the other hand, if you compare it to his death in the books with Kraz and, you know, the whole line, then comes at Barristan Selmy or Barristan the Bold and Kraz came. I mean, it's a little homoerotic, but it is a crowning moment of badass for the character. And I just wonder why they killed him off at this point instead of saving that slightly more awesome, slightly more epic moment for later, and how they're going to change, you know, the intrigue between Hisdar and Daario and the Shave Pate and the Sons of Harpies and Barristan being caught in the middle and then Dany taking off on Drogon and him left behind to try to serve best his interests, or her interest rather. Martin's razor and all, and that's a very complicated, you know, the whole Myrinese knot is a whole complicated thing, and it can definitely be reduced in complexity and still have most of the themes. I just, you know, again, wish we could have had that last moment with him. Now, I know we left it in the main cast that maybe he's dead, maybe he's not. I think they left it like that ambiguous on a television show, but since this is the spoiler section, I did see an interview with the actor who plays Selmy, Ian McElhenney, and he seemed to indicate that was his final scene, that he's not coming back, and that he himself, as a fan of the books and who's read it, thought he was safe, because as we all know, he's still alive and kicking in the books. So, kind of a bummer. I'm wondering if they will give that later scene that we talked about, I wonder if they'll give that to Daario or somebody else, or maybe Grey Worm, as some kind of vengeance for him. I don't know, but I was sad to see him go, and shocked. And if they end up killing Grey Worm too, then wow, that's just going to be pretty impressive. But I could see it working as a way to show how alone Dany is, and again, it's kind of swept away for Jorah and Tyrion. Although, again, it could just be that it just shows her without all of her traditional support, the people that she's leaned on to protect her and advise her and kind of derive some of her moral authority from. Eliminating those is interesting to make her feel really alone and isolated.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. we recently watched King Arthur: Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We also talked in the main cast about the possibility of Arya killing Ser Meron Trance, which would explain his prominence in her prayers earlier this season. Of course, we know in the books, Arya kills Darian, a deserter from the Night's Watch. Now, what I forgot is that as a direct result of that, of her kind of flying solo and being Arya Stark, she's given the Milk of Blindness by the acolytes at the House of Black and White. I thought we were beyond that in her story arc, but there a lot of people reminded me that no, the blindness comes later. So I'm kind of excited to see that. I think that'll be really cool. Meron Trant is a shit, so that'll be entertaining. The other comment I want to touch in before we get to the feedback, and we got a lot of it, and a pretty healthy spoiler segment at the end, is that there are some people disappointed. Got a lot of emails of people disappointed that Jim didn't take the bait on the R plus L equals J hints that the show's laying down and the hints that I kind of gave him. And I can sense your frustration because I kind of wish we could run with that. I think now the show, you know, and there's a lot of people skeptical about whether this emailer is legit. I mean, I don't know. You can never be sure. I do have a few things that I look for in emails as far as phrases and wording and spelling and things of that nature to try to weed out the people that are being disingenuous. But I thought after this week, the show itself had dropped enough hints if a show watcher was observant to start to have this theory. And to suppress it, even if this was a plant, to suppress the discussion, I thought would be just as artificial as letting someone kind of maybe too on the nose draw the connections there. But those connections were there to be made. It's not none of these theories that we considered, you have to have book knowledge to make them work. Having said that, if you do have book knowledge, they're super obvious. And I think a lot of people are disappointed that Jim doesn't jump on that. And I think there's another thing, another angle to consider, which is I think Jim is a little intimidated by how steeped in the lore I am. And sometimes when I ask him a question that's just a surface question, I think he thinks I'm trying to dig at something deeper and he shies away because he doesn't want to sound like an idiot or, you know, say something that would be foolish from a book reader's perspective. So, you know, again, I'm in a position where I have to play a light touch. I bring these things up, and he either takes them and runs with them, which he sometimes does, or sometimes they fall flat. And I much prefer that. I've listened to other Game of Thrones podcasts where they have a book reader and a show watcher dynamic, and again, the whole time I feel like the book readers are just setting up the show watchers and prompting them and elbowing them and like, until the show watcher starts basically reciting what the book reader wants them to say. And that's not fun for anybody. And the other thing is I like to throw in just enough counterpoints and a lot of theories that don't go anywhere that, you know, I kind of pride myself in not telegraphing the big moment. So if a show watcher's listening and like Aaron's like suddenly becomes the prosecutor and he's badgering the witness and he's leading them, oh, this must be something significant. Whereas if I just offer it out there and sometimes it lands, sometimes it doesn't, you can't tell the difference between me guiding it as a book reader and, you know, lucky guesses as a show watcher. And that's the way I like to keep it because I think that's the only way to truly be spoiler free. Is to, you know, make it as blind as possible from my delivery. And that was the whole, you know, the joke with the mildly interesting is that, you know, I come up with a neutral response that I can use no matter what the other co-host says. And as long as I keep it that the same, I mean, people can say, well, I can tell in the tone of voice or I can do this or do that. And I sometimes play games with that too. So that's one of the things I do that's fun and interesting for me in the podcast. Sometimes it doesn't work and it's not as interesting from a book reader's perspective, or a book reader would want them to go a little bit further. But, you know, that's what this segment's for. So just wanted to get that out as well. Let's get on to the feedback. Matthew Y says, since we've gotten foreshadowing of Cersei's walk of shame and the assault of the High Septon, I'm wondering if the seizing of Loras for being a famed sword swallower is more telegraphing for what's to come with both Margaery and Cersei. Perhaps since Tana, I believe is how you pronounce it, Tana Meriwether was never cast and Margaery as a virgin had been taken out of the equation, what is the possibility that Margaery attempts to seduce Cersei and the Queen Mother uses these advances and or a night of deviant pleasure against her, possibly feeling that any wrongdoing in the Faith Militant's eyes would be overlooked because of her position of being their benefactor? As Tyrion once said, Cersei was raised to value money too highly. I know there is a possibly low chance of this happening because of the scene of Lancel mentioning the boar and their incestuous summer fling, all of that basically shouting at us that Lancel will probably be Cersei's downfall. But that wouldn't implicate Margaery in any way. And while both women are aware of being opponents, neither knows to what degree the other is invested in this little war. So what do you think, Ser? Margaery is free and loose with sexuality, and Cersei preaches at the militant Church of the Vag. Are we getting a Tyrell swamp scene this season in lieu of a Mirish swamp? Either way, poor Tommen loses again. Matt, it's not bad. I think the problem is I don't think that Margaery is dumb enough to try to seduce Cersei and think that would be successful. And that would just come off as really desperate on her character's part. And I don't buy that. And even Cersei is not dumb enough to let that happen and kind of sell it like Margaery's getting one over on her. What I think is going to happen is that now the High Septon has his Faith Militant. He'll use Lancel's confessions, which I believe they heavily implied that Lancel's come clean about everything and is seeking forgiveness from the Seven. So I think the High Septon already knows a lot about Cersei's misdeeds. It's just that he wasn't in a position that he could just seize her. Well, now she's given him an army, and now that army has made her the Kingsguard back down publicly, you know, there's one of those little pet theories I threw out that I don't really believe in. The High Septon maybe is co-opted by his own army and that he's some benevolent guy and they're some, you know, they've subverted him. I don't think that's true. I just think that his hands were tied and he was appearing to be this pious kind of bumpkin type character just so he can rope Cersei in for his ultimate ends. So I think that he'll use Lancel's confessions, as you say, to take Cersei into custody. I think it's more likely. I just don't know how far it's going to go. It could be, you know, it's just bad enough, the incest thing with her cousin. It could be that they make this connection to her children and Jaime. That would actually be a threat to King Tommen, which might be enough for Tommen to call his Uncle Kevin off the bench at Castle Rock, which would give us a nice beat in the final episode. You know, that would probably all happen in the end of episode 9, episode 10. Kevin comes riding into King's Landing. It's been in chaos this entire season. It's been rocked by scandal after scandal. He rides in heroically to right the ship just in time for Varys to put a crossbow bolt in him. And I think that would be a pretty sweet way to end the season. Then again, last year, I thought Lady Stoneheart would be a pretty sweet way to end season 4. So what the hell do I know? Moving on to Mike R. Said, after listening to the latest spoiler cast, I wanted to write in against the Howland Reed as the High Septon or High Sparrow theory. It's a fun tinfoil, but I hope it's not true because I think it's essential to the story of the reborn Faith Militant that it's spontaneous, a grassroots movement of, by, and for the common folk. They've been trampled upon by the nobility for ages, and now they're finally becoming radicalized and they're fighting back. If it turns out that the whole movement was masterminded by some highborn lord making his own play in the Game of Thrones, that story would be completely undermined, in my view. I don't think GRRM would do that, or GRM, as I like to call him, so that the High Sparrow is just who he appears to be, a nobody, which is the whole point. Well, that is a fair point, but I don't know if I agree with you that I think it would ruin the whole story, because, again, what's the larger point? Is Gurm making a point that radical calls like the French Revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution are a good thing? I think it's just as arguable to say that these popular uprisings of the lower classes eventually being co-opted by powerful charismatic leaders can be just as horrific as a brutal dictatorship. You know, these leaderless movements run amok and harnessed by ambitious men or ambitious women, for that matter, can be just as bad as a King Joffrey. And I think that's an important point to make. And I think it's consistent with the world that Gurm is kind of laying out here for us. It would be kind of odd if this powerful, charismatic leader would be a hero. Like, if he was Howland Reed and he's doing all this manipulations for the greater good, that would be interesting rather than having him be like a Hitler or a Stalin clone. And I could see that being interesting. But, you know, there is a not insubstantial amount of evidence or a lot of logical flaws with Howland Reed being the High Sparrow. I'm not disputing that. I just really like the theory. Moving on, Hunter E. Dub says, what do you think about Melisandre's intention is for hooking up with Jon? She obviously knows he's royalty and that his blood is powerful, and that she mentions something about a shadow. Is she trying to make another shadow murder baby? If so, who is the target? Is she over Stannis and wants to shift her powers to Jon? And she plans to murder him the same way he murdered Renly? I can't think of anyone else in the North that she'd want to take out. The show has spent a lot of time with Shireen, but why would she get to kill her? Surely not Davos or the Black Brothers. We can only hope that Stannis' wife will get got, but that truly makes no sense in terms of the plot. Do shadow babies have other specific sets of skills that don't involve murder? Those are all very good questions, and I don't have great answers for you, but I'm going to give it the old college try. I think having a shadow assassinate Stannis would work well in the context of a freshly resurrected Jon Snow. If Stannis is alone in the time of assassination, which doesn't seem to be, you know, other than Brienne and Catelyn, Stannis almost pulled that off in the original Renly hit, there would be no one around to see a shadow or whatnot, and then who would fill the leadership vacuum there? Would it be some kind of done deal to have Jon arise from the dead, newly freed from his vows as a Black Brother, rise up as a unified leader of the wildlings of the North and the remnants of Stannis' army? Would Stannis' lords go along with that? Would Davos go along with that? Would it even matter? Another possibility is it could be that Melisandre just needs to have sex with Jon and can store that power. It's not like you have sex, 6 hours later, you have a shadow baby. Maybe she can control the timing of the release of this offspring, or she can accelerate it or delay it as it suits her purpose. Again, don't know. This is one of Jim's complaints of magic. It could be anything they want it to be. But it could be like, you know, once she gets his seed up inside her, that's like a round of ammo that she's got in her clip and she can expend it at a later point. And she's essentially perhaps trying to stockpile these weapons of royal blood and royal seed so she can use them at a later date. Honestly, I don't think we know enough about her purposes or her powers to know one way or another. Nor do we know what happens next at the Wall or Winterfall. I mean, that's one of the burning questions of the Winds of Winter. What happens to Jon? What's the real story behind the Pink Letter? What really happens at the Wall after the coup? And it'll be interesting to see if we get any answers at the end of this season, or whether essentially they're going to find a way to stall enough that this season is going to end right as Dance and Feast ends.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Gerard M. said, in your instant cast, either you or Jim mentioned something about Littlefinger being in hot water with the High Sparrow when he gets to King's Landing. In support of this, I offer the following. 1. Do you have a count of how many times Oliver has shouted, "This establishment is owned by Lord Peter Baelish," so far this season? And 2. Baelish has promised Sansa that he would be back, and we know how well that goes in this series, let alone who it is that's making that promise. Put a pin in that, Gerard, because Aelin C., I believe is how you pronounce her name, has a couple things to say about this as well. She says, or perhaps he, I'm not familiar with the name, "I've read some speculation that the reason Cersei summons Littlefinger has to do with Loras or Oliver, since Oliver works for Littlefinger. I really like that speculation, but what I'm wondering is if Littlefinger will have something to do with Cersei being imprisoned by the Sparrows. In the books, it was one of the Kettleblacks who confessed to fornicating with the Queen, and I assumed in the show it would be Lancel who spills the beans. But with how far gone Lancel is at the moment, why hasn't he already said something? Or if he has confessed, what is the Faith Militant waiting for? I'm thinking back to Season 1 conversation that Littlefinger and Cersei have about knowledge is power versus power is power, and wondering if the show will circle back to that idea." We touched on a little bit of this before. I think these are all excellent points. It could be that Littlefinger must confess some crimes to himself, and I could see him spinning these in such a way that it lands with Cersei being in maximum trouble. I mean, Littlefinger knows a lot about her dirty little secrets after all. Particularly her dirtiest secret, which is King Tommen sitting on the throne, is a bastard born of incest. He could say that's the reason Ned is beheaded, to cover that secret up, and that the Faithful are already pissed about them killing Ned because it profaned the Great Sept of Baelor. And, you know, he could say, "Oh, it was all Cersei, and she blackmailed me, and she threatened me with death," and maybe he could get off with clemency and then land her in a lot of hot water. You know, they're setting up that whole abomination and incest thing with the crowd, so that's got to go somewhere. That would be kind of satisfying, because by recalling Littlefinger back to King's Landing, it would be Cersei kind of sealing her doom, and that's one of the themes in the book that I'm kind of worried doesn't play out in the show, because they've made Cersei be a little bit more rational, a little bit more clever in her plans. I don't want to miss the fact that she is essentially, through her own paranoia and her own pride, putting the noose around her very own neck. So, Aelin C. continues with some other points. Is it safe to assume that Sansa is not only taking the role of Jean Poole, but also Wyman Manderly as well? If that's the case, I'll really miss the Manderly-Frey pie plot, as I absolutely loved it in the books. But depending on how this is Sansa and Winterfell plot plays out, I'm fairly excited about this remix. I'm not sure if you missed it, but I think there's still a strong possibility of the great John Umber fulfilling the role of Lord Manderly, adding to the Winterfell clusterfuck that's currently shaping up. So I talked a little bit about that in the last show, and I think that's a strong possibility. If not, it could totally be an Oxen's Razor situation where, yes, the Frey pie is pretty cool and all that, but it just gets omitted for a streamlining. And I still think with Brienne, with Sansa, with Stannis marching, you've got enough converging on Winterfell that you do not need Lord Too Fat to Sit a Horse to come there and bake Frey pies. And they might just save the whole Frey revenge, because, you know, a lot of people are talking about Red Wedding 2.0, et cetera, et cetera. We haven't got there in the books either. So assuming that stuff all takes place in the Winds of Winter, I could see them punting the whole Frey situation to a further season, dealing the Boltons in this season, leaving it to kind of a mystery, kind of ending on a pink letter type of note for this season, and then kind of dealing with all the Stark family business in the next season. But setting all that up. Speaking of the phrase, she continues, I'm starting to think that wherever Walder Frey's fate might be in the books, and I'm banking on him getting slaughtered at the Red Wedding 2.0, in the show it's going to be Arya that kills him. Unless, of course, the show just added his name to the list because it's gotten so super short. With Lady Stoneheart 99% sure, for sure out, I'm going with Arya. And indeed, the only problem I have with this theory is that why would the Faceless Men send Arya to do that task? Or do we think that as soon as she completes her training, she's going to betray the Faceless Men and go rogue? How would that even work? I mean, I think you'd have some kind of Jason Bourne type situation where all the best killers in the world, in this case with magically enhanced super spy powers, will be hunting down a teenage girl who just recently became a trainee of theirs. I can buy Arya can be a talented killer and be on par with any one Faceless Man, but could she stand against them all? I mean, is her warging going to be enough of a talent to allow her to be safe from the Faceless Men come gunning for her? There has to be a reason that they would send her, in my mind. And I hope it's not just for fan service. I hope that there's an elegant reason that Martin connects Sarya's water dancing training with her experience with the Jaqen on the way to the wall, with her experience at the Harrenhal, with her experiences at the House of Black and White. They connect all this and allow her to have a chance to get revenge of her enemies that somehow sanctioned by the House of Black and White, by the Faceless Men, and that somehow this is all going to tie together. I really hope that's the case, but I just don't have enough of the plot to see where that's going as of yet. It's not a problem with your theory, of course. It's just that there's not an obvious link to say, yes, that's a cool thing. How do we get from where we're at now to this cool thing happening? That's where it kind of breaks down for me. Moving on, Luke G said, with the Faith Militant's knowledge of Tommen being a bastard, they could potentially wage war against the crown. I feel like the show could be setting this up by shipping both Meryn Trant and Jaime, our two most notable Kingsguard, out of King's Landing, as well by having Canavan Lannister, the crown's master of war, leaving the capital. I could definitely see a naive Tommen being unprepared for a sudden attack from the Faith Militant's mob and getting taken prisoner. What if an already shamed Cersei, hearing of her son's fate, mentally breaks her into doing the walk of shame? If Tommen getting seized by the Faceless Men happens, this also opens up the door for Robert Strong, a.k.a. the Mountain, a.k.a. Westeros' version of Bane from Batman, to fight for Tommen rather than Cersei in a trial by combat. If this theory is true, it could certainly spice up the other storylines going on as well. If Tommen were to die, the crown would pass to either Myrcella or Stannis by law, correct? I'm not sure how that would work in the six main kingdoms, but in Dorne, they would surely crown Myrcella and proclaim her as the lawful heir. This is assuming Marge isn't already pregnant with Sir Tommen Pounds Jr., which is also an interesting possibility, as the show has hinted at this 3 to 4 times already. If Dorne crowns Myrcella, that definitely brings 3 to 4 times. You're talking about Tommen's record there, you sly dog. If Dorne crowns Myrcella, it definitely brings a new, interesting importance to both Stannis and Jaime's storyline. I think the showrunners definitely have it ending to kill off sweet, sweet Tommen. For sure, I agree that they have it in him, Luke. I think, though, my problem with this theory, and I'm the crumpler of foil this week, apparently, because I'm just I feel like I'm shitting on everybody's. But if you kill Tommen, it seems like it's too neatly resolving the crown to either Myrcella or Stannis, which would make either Dorne or Stannis's or both's positions much stronger and leave the Lannisters relatively so much weaker as to almost be irrelevant. I mean, the Lannisters would just simply be done. And I feel like in the case of Dance with Dragons and the appearance of Robert the Strong, all that at the end implies that even with the death of Kevin, Cersei is just now getting started. So this kind of thing is like using the Hubble telescope. I was watching a documentary on Hubble when I was doing this note, so it's stuck in my mind. It's like using the Hubble to see the very edge of the known universe. It's great that you can see it, but it's hard to use that information and then say definitively what's even further than that. I don't know. I've only seen this far. You're talking about guessing what Cersei and Prince Dorne are going to do at the end of Dance of Dragons, and that's where I feel like we're moving from analyzing the books for clues for the series and vice versa, analyzing the series for clues for the books, and we're just making stuff up. We need more book or more show, you know, specifically the 6 more episodes before we can start definitively saying, aha, I think I know where it's going to go for the next season. And that's definitely going to be something fun to do in the wrap-up cast. But right now, I feel like you have to be careful not to suggest a theory which would tip the balance of power too far in any one direction for with all the players left on the board. Or you're just guessing which way you think the power is going to tip, which is interesting. But again, you're as likely to be wrong as you are to be right. Moving on to John Sand, says, I think the Waif might be one of the Sand Snakes. Instead of Sirella and Aurelis or Alaris slash the Sphinx training to be a maester, the Waif is Sirella training to be a faceless woman. In the books, Lady Nim is the fair Sand Snake, while Sirella is the Summer Islander. But the double Ds might have made Sirella the fair Sand Snake to throw book readers off the scent. This explains why the show's Waif has been portrayed very differently from the Waif in the book. If you read Keisha Castle Hughes' interview, and she's the one who plays the spear-wielding Obera Sand, in a recent Variety interview, when answering a question, she's quoted as saying, she wields the same weapon as her father, and she's the most like him in the sense that she has no other aspirations. Some of her other sisters have aspirations to become politicians, or to become septas, or to become faceless women. So perhaps parts of the Old Town plot from the books have been moved to Braavos. Jaqen has already been moved from Braavos to Old Town, and John might send Sam to Braavos to negotiate the Iron Bank to purchase supplies for the Night's Watch. John could mortgage the gift to secure the loan from there. Moving key elements of the Old Town plot to Braavos would fit into how the Double Ds like to condense book plots into the TV show. Just some thoughts that popped into my head after reading the Castle Hughes interview. I like this, and it's a very Martin's Razor kind of situation. But on the other hand, we don't know enough about what Sirella's doing in Old Town yet to know one way or another how this could be a condensing of the plot. This is another kind of Hubble telescope type of situation. But certainly there's enough mystery around Sirella and the Waif to do some identity remixing. And also, why would John send him to negotiate for... I mean, I guess he does do that in the books. He does deal with the... Iron Bankers to get money for, to prepare the Black Brothers for the winter. And I guess Sam could do that. But with, it seems like they're laying tracks with Maester Aemon being old and sick and dying. They're going to need a new Maester, and Sam's going to need training. I'm assuming that there is a point to all this stuff in the books, and it's something about, you know, the Faceless Men trying to get a handle on dragons or magic or something. So... I don't know. Again, I don't know enough to know where they're going and which is better for sure. But it's something to keep an eye on as we move forward. Tom says, I have another two linked crazy theories that you may or may not have come across, and I'd like to hear your thoughts. They're both concerning Ned Stark. I was sparked into thinking more about him after hearing an interview where Sean Bean said, I can come back now, as everyone knows I'm not John's dad. We also know that Bran is a warg. Jon, Rickon, and Arya all have warg dreams, and as the Starks are descended from the First Men, they can warg. So, did Ned warg into something a split second before meeting his maker? The Hound? One of the direwolves? A dragon? The second theory builds on another. If we assume that Arya's dancing master is a faceless man, and in particular Jaqen, we know Ned's arranged Arya's lessons, so does this mean that Ned knows of the Faceless Men or possibly is a Faceless Man? It's a bit more on the crazy side of these theories, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. I don't think Ned is coming back. I don't think he's a Faceless Man. I mean, I'm all for crazy tinfoil theories, but I like to separate, like, you know, Bruce Bolton's a vampire. I like that theory. I think it's cool. There's a lot of text to support it. Ultimately, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not, because if it turns out that he just gets defeated and, you know, becomes a minor point of the whole Song of Ice and Fire, I can still say, hey, I think he's a vampire, because it doesn't matter to the plot, or it could be that it matters big time. You know, it's one of those things where it's not really a falsifiable theory. This one, though, seems like it's pretty falsifiable, and there's a lot of problems with it. We know way too much about Ned's history and his whereabouts, basically his entire life. I mean, we know that he was shipped off to the Vale, and he was raised by Robert Arryn. He then fought in a civil war for the Iron Throne to give to his buddy Robert. He then got married to Catelyn Stark. He had children. He was the Lord Paramount of the North and Warden of the North. that is not consistent with what you would say about a faceless man. He's either the deepest sleeper agent in the history of Westeros, or a faceless man killed him at some point in his life and replaced him so accurately that neither his best friend Robert, his adoptive father John Arryn, his wife or children in later years, none of them could tell the difference. And that stretches my definition of what the faceless men are capable of. As far as warging, my impression is that this is a latent Stark gift that hasn't manifested in a long time. It's somehow connected with the direwolf pups. So I doubt that Ned warged. We are privy in the books and the series and to a lot of his thoughts and his dreams and his point of view. There's not a lot of room for a lot of mystery there, in my opinion. So I don't want to be Rumpler of Tinfoil here, but that's what my gut tells me. Moving on to Pete from House Goat. In the build-up to Season 5 in the UK, we had a Game of Thrones Greatest Moments countdown. This did what it said on the tin, with commentary from celebrity fans and some of the crew and cast accompanying the scene selected. The reason I write this is because one of the commentators was none other than Michelle Fairley, the actress who played Catelyn Stark. It was clearly recorded post-Season 3, as many of the moments came from Season 4. From memory, I don't think any other long-dead characters were used, in fact. It looks like it had been recorded simultaneously to Season 5, as a lot of the cast were in their costumes. Do you think this makes it more likely that Stoneheart will make an appearance at the end of Season 5, or am I just being naively optimistic? I think I even imagined a faded makeup line around her neck, which could have been a scar. See picture attached of the photo I took at the TV at this point. So, I looked at your photo here, and I think it's inconclusive, Pete. It looks like it could just be wrinkles on Michelle's neck, because that's what necks do when you start hitting your 50s. Gravity is a bitch. If you compare that photo to other press photos of her from various different events, you'll see that she has those kind of same lines in all of them, because that's just what her neck's doing. As we discussed in previous weeks, you know, Martin's razor, which is my version of saying the law of character economy, is strong with this show. Martin's razor suggests that all denials by the Double D's and Michelle herself are legit, and that Lady Stoneheart's character and motivations, if they're carried on at all, which I assume they are because I feel like it's pretty damn important what happens between Brienne and Jaime, that they're going to be carried on by Sansa or Brienne. And it's been an odd voyage for me because if you listened to me last year in the wrap-up cast, I was one of the foremost leaders in that there's no way they can get away with doing away with Lady Stoneheart. But now, when I see how the Double D's have really skillfully reshuffled the deck so far in this season with Jaime and Brienne and Sansa, I feel like I've just let all that go. Not only do I think that Sansa or Brienne could lead the Brotherhood for Stark Vengeance as well as Lady Stoneheart, I actually think they could do it better and in a more satisfying way. I mean, yes, it would be very creepy to see Michelle Fairley in zombie makeup and, you know, hissing out all of her commands and orders, but imagine what Sophie Turner or Gwendolyn Christie can do in a scene where Sansa is ordering Brienne to prove her loyalty by killing Jaime Lannister. I think that would be incredible. And that is the, again, the most thing most makes sense in my mind. So hate to be the bearer of bad news. I moved on from Lady Stoneheart. I would be pleasantly surprised if they bring her back at this point. Robbie, seeing Tyrion's face when the dragons are flying over the city in the coming scenes, I thought about his previous interest in dragons and wildfire. I'm not sure I recall the reference of these previous scenes. I know there's a scene of dragons flying over King's Landing, but I'm not seeing that in connection with Tyrion's face. But regardless, I don't think it's important for the rest of the email. Then I remember he gave a design of a saddle to Bran early on. What do you think about the possibility of him training dragons for Dany, or maybe designing a saddle for Dany to ride the dragons? I think there's a DreamWorks movie in 3D in two installments that lays out this whole plot point. Anyway, maybe he could ride a dragon being of smaller stature. So we talked a little bit about Tyrion being a secret Targaryen last year in the Dany deep dive prophecy tinfoil section. And by the way, if you want to hear that, I have a link to all of this tinfoil archives in the show notes for each of these spoiler podcasts. So if you click on the show notes, which are on baldmove.com, or they're probably in the show description of your podcast player that you're listening to this on right now, presumably, there's a link to the archive, and it's got a link to the podcast and the time code for where this tinfoil for that week starts. so you can quickly find it. Anyway, I'm not sure if I mentioned his saddle design as a mark in the theory's favor of him being a secret Targaryen and thus being one of the three heads of the dragon, but you're absolutely right. I think it's going to be some combination of magic dragon horns, Tyrion's saddle making know-how, Bran's warging. They're going to end up coming together and combining to help Dany and the other of the heads of the dragon, whoever they may be, master their mounts. I'm going to butcher your name. I apologize, but I believe it's Oisanau. She begins, or he begins again. I'm unfamiliar with the name, so set me straight if you would. Says Night Watch mutiny will still happen, and it'll be led by Sir Alistair Thorne and Ollie betraying John as well. Martin's razor would seem to indicate that yes, with all this emphasis on Ollie and his relationship with John and his bitterness and his hatred towards the wildlings, that would really pay that off. And I mean, they've cast Bowen Marsh, and he's been mentioned a time or two, and he's been in the background several times, but no show watcher gives a shit about Marsh the way they do about Thorne and Ollie. Hell, I didn't even know that was true until I started digging on IMDb and some of the Game of Thrones wikis that, yes, they have actually cast a Bowen Marsh. So I think watching old Thorne pour poison into Ollie's ear and use his anger against John or wildlings and use that against John would be very entertaining in a way that Game of Thrones is often entertaining, watching bad people do despicable things, relatively innocent people, and manipulate them. She continues, the prostitute marine that seems to have a hard on for killing the Unsullied will turn out to be the Green Grace. This is the dried whores who I refer to her as. Turns out to be the Green Grace and the leader of the Sons of the Harpy. I actually think it's a little too obvious given the fact that we only see her wearing green clothing and she keeps sending Dany's troop to her deaths. We're also probably going to have the show called Shocking Reveal that Hisdar Zolorak is in cahoots with the Green Grace to bring Dany down. I actually don't know enough about the Green Grace to comment much on this, but I'm actually a fan of the whole Shave Pate being the one behind the attempted Dany poisoning of the cicadas or the locusts or whatever the hell she's eating and all the other machinations against her at the end of Dance. I highly recommend Googling for the essay Untangling the Meereenese Plot. And remember that Meereenese is spelled with a double E after the M and after the R. And it does an excellent job at outlining all of that and all of the Shave Pate's complicity. I might visit that actually later as a tinfoil segment, but it is a huge, broad topic. It's like 5,000 word essays. It's similar to the Grand Northern Conspiracy in scope. So even as a two-parter, that'd be tough to cover. But it's all elegantly laid down in a series of essays already. I really hate when someone's done the work to kind of tie this in a bow to just kind of read and plagiarize their work. I like it better when I have to take four or five Reddit threads and then find the quotes and, you know, tie it up into a bow myself. That's kind of how I prefer to roll. But we'll see. If the Winds of Winter doesn't come out next year, I might get desperate. Continuing, Littlefinger will be responsible for Kevin Lannister's death instead of Varys since he wants to cause chaos. Interesting theory. I kind of doesn't leave Varys much room to be doing anything, though. It's almost too much Martin's razor. I mean, I guess it does free Varys from having to make the trip across the Narrow Sea again, but, you know, what else is Varys going to be doing? If he goes right to the Queen, I guess, and is her advisor? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that. Continuing, I believe that the scene where Bronn saves Jaime from the snake in the Sands of Dorne symbolizes a future scene of Bronn saving Jaime's life from the Sand Snake and is most likely dying in the process. I also believe when Jaime said he wanted to die in the arms of a woman he loves, he will either die strangling Cersei to death or in the arms of Brienne, similarly to the bathtub scene in Season 3. This snake foreshadowing stuff is hot. It's good stuff. I like it. And the more I think of it, the more I think Bronn is going to go the way of Okart, leaving Jaime to play the role of Balin Swan. So I like all that. That's good stuff. Moving on, for questions she has for me, given the fact that Melisandre seems to be leaving the wall with Stannis, unlike in the books, do you think the Brotherhood of Without Banners will be reintroduced as a way for Thoros of Myr to bring back Jon Snow from the death? Nah. I mean, it's a possibility, but I think it's far more likely she'll go back to the wall then the Brotherhood makes that trek all the way up there during the start of winter, no less, because it, you know, I buy a small party can get back and forth from the wall in the dead of winter. I find it less likely to believe that like a band of brothers, of, you know, like 100 guys can be making that trek. So that's just my gut feeling. And again, like, I don't know. Stannis says he's not going to make the same mistake, but that doesn't mean that Melisandre won't weasel out of the commitment somehow. Or it doesn't mean that Stannis won't change his mind, or that events, you know, just like Melisandre changed her mind about Davos, she could turn on a dime and change her mind about this and say something about seeing in the fires. She has to stay here to protect Shireen or to help Jon Snow or to do whatever. And Stannis is going to be okay. Or yeah, I don't know. I'm just making stuff up. So, but that's kind of my feelings on that. I don't like it. And again, I want the Brotherhood to stay down south so they can hook up with Brienne or Sansa. I mean, relatively south, that is. I'm a believer like you in the notion of the High Sparrow as Hal and Reed. However, surprising wrinkle in that tinfoil theory that I've yet to see one bring up is, to put it bluntly, the age of the High Sparrow. After all, I always pictured him younger in the book due to the fact that he was supposed to be Jojen and Mira's father. However, in the show, he is as old, if not older, than Tywin Lannister. Don't get me wrong, I think Jonathan Pryce is an excellent actor to play the role, but isn't it hard to believe that he would have at one time been Eddard Stark's younger compatriot? For goodness sakes, if the show's High Sparrow is any good representation of the book's character, he is old enough to be Ned Stark's father in both the show and the books. Oof, that's actually a very good point. I mean, age is a pretty variable thing in television, and this show seems to age up characters for their own convenience, but there doesn't seem to be a great reason to do so when they could have just had a guy Sean Bean's age play the High Sparrow if they wanted to make that connection in the future. So that is pretty strong evidence, if we're using the show to influence the books, that theory is bupkis, which would be a shame in my opinion. Maybe not. I don't know. I feel like a lot of people have crumpled that tinfoil for me in the last 2 weeks. So might be moving off that.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Kevin H. Okay, here's a theory of mine. The Walking Dead is one of the most successful shows ever. Naturally, there comes Fear the Walking Dead. Breaking Bad has birthed Better Call Saul. So can we think a ton of written material, or can we think of a ton of written material in A Song of Ice and Fire that the Double D's aren't going to have time to cover in Game of Thrones? Yep, and it's from A Feast of Crows. Imagine a spinoff show that takes place during the same time period as A Song of Ice and Fire, but focuses on the Iron Islands, Victarion, Aerys Okard, etc. Maybe even throw Lady Stoneheart in there for good measure. Occasionally, we'd be intersecting with major characters from A Song of Ice and Fire. What do you think? I don't know if it would be interesting as a spinoff. I mean, sure, there's lots of material there, as you mentioned, but if they don't go into it in the scope of the series, then by definition, it's not going to be vital to the main plot. And if it's not vital to the main plot, then why retell it after you've told your story? I mean, this is different than Martin going down dead ends as a way to do red herrings and kind of, you know, throw us off his trail a bit. You know, this is essentially bringing up red herrings and dead ends after you've already told your main story, because there's no way in hell HBO spins this off until Game of Thrones is complete. I think it's just too expensive. It's too much time and money investment for them. Now, having said that, as a lot of people have talked about, and George R. R. Martin himself has raised a point, there a prequel series about the Dunkin' Egg series, the Hedge Knight series, would be very cool, or fleshing out previous Targaryen dynasties. I mean, like, look at the first 150 pages of A World of Ice and Fire. It's all about all these Targaryen dynasties and the schemings and the rebellions and the dances with dragons and all this stuff. And what about, you know, HBO used to do Tales from the Crypt, right? What if they did a Tales from Westeros and each week it's a different hour long story from these past segments, or with a few 2 or 3 episode arcs to tell more complex stories, or, you know, that kind of framework I think would be kind of interesting. And I feel like it'll be hard for HBO to turn down more Game of Thrones money, because this is a runaway success for them and there's a lot more backstory to tell, and I'm sure George Martin will be willing to sell it to him. So, I'd also love for HBO to continue the fantasy vein, but go into different works. Like, I'm currently in the middle of reading the Mistborn series, which I think would make for a fantastic adaptation. You know, again, I'm very early on in the books, but so far there's nothing that's like, oh my God, that's unfilmable. Certainly nothing even on the scale of Game of Thrones. And it's got an interesting, very technical and cohesive view of magic that it's very well grounded and thought out and not too extravagant. I like to see them do that. But one of the reasons Game of Thrones is so good is that it's a passion project for the Double D's. They read these books and they had in their mind's eye all these key moments and how they'd bring it to film, and it was something that was important to them. HBO would have to get someone as passionate about Dunkin' Egg or Mistborn or whatever they're going to do, or it's going to suck. I mean, look at the later seasons of True Blood for an example of when HBO gets stuck with an adaptation where the original creators and writers get bored, lose interest, and check out. It ain't pretty. So I'm all for more Game of Thrones, more George R. R. Martin, but you also got to be careful of what you wish for. Moving on to Juan C. says, I feel like we've all missed out on a really big hint. Master Aemon is sick. John asks Samwell where Master Aemon is, and Samwell replies that he's not feeling well. He missed John's first meeting as the Lord Commander, which proved to be an important and pivotal one. It resulted in the beheading of a high-ranking member of the Night's Watch, Janos Slynt. I feel like Aemon has knowledge of what really happened at and after the tourney of Harrenhal, and his nephew, Rhaegar, and possibly knowledge of Bloodraven. He might also be the one who convinced Lord Commander Mormont to make John his steward, as he knew how important he was. I can see a deathbed scene for him, Tarly and John, where he drops a major hint. It might not be a blatant confirmation, but a heavy hint at the end of the season that tantalizes us all summer long. Well, Juan, if you're right, we might be getting that scene this week, because the episode's entitled Kill the Boy, which of course is a reference to Maester Aemon's counsel to John upon becoming Lord Commander. You need to kill the boy to let the man be born, essentially, you know, swallow a bag of cement and get hard. Personally, they're really going to have to sell me on how Aemon would know that there's something special about Jon other than, you know, his leadership and his courage and his honor and all that stuff. All that crap. Melisandre, I can believe because she's spooky, right? Howland Reed, I can believe because, of course, he was there at the Tower of Joy. Bran, of course, I can believe because he's spooky too, and he can green see the past and the future, and he could somehow commune with Jon in the future through weirwoods or whatever. But they have to be careful with this reveal and just not half-ass it. I think we're all agreed on that. And I'll reserve judgment until I see it, if you're right or not. But a deathbed confession is a bit too much Master Yoda, a bit too much old Ben Kenobi's ghost explaining all the backstory, a bit too much half-assed for me. Because again, how would he know? What is the logical connection from him knowing that Jon is a secret Targaryen? I don't know. Maybe someone's got the answer, and I'll change my mind on a future installment of Spoiler Cast. Okay, for this week's tinfoil theory, we got something a little bit different. I started this segment, I was going to do a roundup of some of the sillier theories, a lot of the identity switching theories. And if you ever hear me get into Benjen Stark equals Daario, you'll know I'm scraping the bottom of the tinfoil theory barrel. But I got all that stuff researched. I got a couple more. And then I got this Daario equals Euron Greyjoy. And I started digging into it. And I started seeing that there's a lot of meat on these bones. And in the end, I came in thinking this is going to be a joke. It's going to be a lighter thing. I ended up being totally swayed. And I blew this segment out into a standalone. So we're going to consider the theory that Daario Naharis is the same person as Euron Greyjoy in disguise. Say what? This theory was popularized by Nittany Lion Country and Heraclitus 94 on Reddit, and it actually kind of sprang as a joke from all the other Daario is this guy, Benjen Stark is this other guy theories that were going around. It was kind of a meme at the time, and someone suggested this as a joke, but people started looking at the textual evidence and seeing that it had legs. So let's dive right into it. First of all, it's considered a physical description. This is how the books choose to describe Daario.
And Daario Naharis was flamboyant even for Tyroshi. His beard was cut into three prongs and dyed blue, the same color as his eyes, and the curly hair that fell to his collar. Dany ran her hand down his back, tracing the line of his spine. His skin was smooth beneath her touch, almost hairless. His skin is silk and satin.
Now, let's look how the books describe Euron Greyjoy.
Euron was the most comely of Lord Kellan's sons, and 3 years of exile had not changed that. His hair was still black as a midnight sea, with never a whitecap to be seen, and his face was still smooth and pale beneath his neat dark beard. A black leather patch covered Euron's left eye, but his right was blue as a summer sky.
Now, notice the similarities here. They're both very beautiful. They're both very pale and smooth skin. They both have beards. Euron's described as neat. Obviously, Daario's is a little bit more flamboyant. It's forked and it's dyed blue. But we already have precedence in the whole Griff and Young Griff situation with John Connington and Aegon, of having people dyeing their hair and their beards blue as a disguise. Also, Euron has blue lips, but you got to think, if you want to disguise a prominent physical feature like that, blue beard is not a bad way to go about it. They both have blue eyes, or at least the eyes of Euron that we can see. Supposedly, he's got a black crow's eye underneath that eye patch, but who knows? That could just be flair. So there are some striking physical similarities. In fact, there's some startling show evidence too, some television evidence that supports this as well. One of the strongest is the mysterious casting of recasting of Daario. Now, the official story, and I'm not trying to do any conspiracy type work here, but the official story is that the Euro trash looking Daario was in a new Transporter film and he had a scheduling conflict, so they got this other guy. It's interesting though. You know, Euron's not a character we've seen in the television show. We might never see him. But if you go to, like, one of the wikis of Ice and Fire or, you know, Westeros.org, and you look at some of the fan art of the way people have rendered him, he looks a lot like the new Daario because the two characters are very similar as they're described in the books. Now, okay, so that's physical similarities, whatever. What else you got for me, Aaron? How about how the books describe their personality? Both Daario and Euron seem to be very boastful, larger-than-life characters. In fact, here is something... Here is Daario bragging about himself.
A lake of slaughter, a thing of beauty, and many a tumbler and fire dancer has wept to the gods that they might be half so quick, a quarter so graceful. I would tell you the names of all the men I have slain, but before I could finish, your dragons would grow large as castles. The walls of Yankai would crumble into yellow dust, and winter would come and go and come again.
And now consider Euron bragging about himself.
Yet I have sailed farther than any of them. Only one living kraken has never known defeat. Only one has never bent his knee. Only one has sailed to Ashai by the shadow and seen wonders and terrors beyond imagining.
Both men are described as dangerous. Here's what the books have to say about Daario.
The Tyroshi sellsword was not a good man. No one needed to tell her that. Under the smiles and jests, he was dangerous, even cruel.
And here's what the books have to say about Euron.
It was dangerous to speak so to the crow's eye, even when his smiling eye was shining with amusement.
In the books, Daario leads a mercenary group of sellswords called the Storm Crows. In the books, Euron is known as the Crow's Eye. Let's read how Euron describes himself in the books.
A smile played across Euron's blue lips. I am the storm, my lord. The first storm and the last.
Now, it has to be said that in the show, Daario leads the Second Sons. But that's not really a problem for this theory, because as a point of fact, Euron is literally the second son of Quellan Greyjoy and the younger brother of Balin. So he is a second son. Speaking of the television series, we talked about how they recast Daario to be someone more fitting the description of Daario from the books, and also, incidentally, Euron Greyjoy. But in Season 3, Episode 8, Eurotrash Daario claims to lack horrors very much, he just refuses to pay for them. You might say he refuses to pay the gold price for horrors, which is an important part of Ironborn culture, and kind of something that comes out of nowhere. In Season 4, Episode 1, Daario makes Dany a gift of wildflowers, which he calls Harpy's Gold. He says they're beautiful, but poisonous. Note Victarion's commentary on Euron from A Feast for Crows.
A king must needs be open-handed, he tried to tell himself, but another voice whispered, Euron's gifts are poisoned.
In the books, Euron gives 100 ships to Victarion to present to Dany as her fleet and as a wedding present. He arrives at Slaver's Bay with just 93 ships, having lost several to storms. In Season 4, Episode 8, Daario claims to have secured a fleet for Dany from the Myrinese Navy. How many ships? 93. Now, I know I've noted this before as evidence that the Iron Islanders are being martined, razored out of the series, but until I did this research, I had no idea that the numbers of ships were exactly the same. Now, this still works as a Martin's razor, but damn. It might be easier to merge Daario and Euron in the television series because they're the same damn character. Now, if you're anything like me at this point, you are probably saying, this is all well and good, but how the hell can Daario and Euron be on opposite sides of the known world over the span of A Feast for Crows and A Dance of Dragons? Daario is stuck over in Slaver's Bay, all the way across the world, all the way on the other side of Westeros, on the Iron Islands. We've got Euron going to the Kingsmoot, and then he's reaving in the Shield Islands, etc. How is this going to work out? Well, for what it's worth, it's right about here that I sat up and started taking this theory a lot more seriously. So the guys from the Boiled Leather Audio Hour, which is a very popular Game of Thrones podcast, possibly better than this one, have put together a chronological listing of the Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons episodes. And this is for, you know, because famously this has got a parallel structure. It's very similar to The Two Towers and The Return of the King, where one book deals exclusively with characters and situations in one part of the world, and the other part comes in and fills the gaps that happen in the other part. But they're chronologically taking place at exactly the same time. So what these guys have done have torn apart the chapters and put them together into an order that you can read chronologically, which is easier to follow and kind of more engaging. So The thing is, they've done this, and guess what? Dario and Euron's chapters never overlap. In fact, there are large unexplained gaps in their story that line up perfectly to allow the one guy to be in one continent, simultaneously being another guy on another continent. Let me explain. In A Dance with Dragons Chapter 3, this is the first Daenerys chapter, Dario has been sent away to try to make an alliance with the Lazarene. In the second Daenerys chapter, which is A Dance with Dragons Chapter 12, Dario is still away. In fact, Dany is starting to worry about why he's been gone for so long without word. In Daenerys Chapter 3, which is A Dance with Dragons Chapter 17, it's the last time we see Dany before we actually get to the Kingsmoot. She receives a letter from the Stormcrow saying that they're returning finally from L'Azhar, but she notes that the Stormcrows are still many days away. Now, here's an interesting coincidence. Dario was sent to L'Azhar with many gifts. The book says he went to the Land's Men with many gems and gold plate. Then Euron shows up at the Kingsmoot with chests full of gold and treasures as a part of his plot to win over the Iron Islanders. Interesting that Dario went to L'Azhar with all these gifts from Dany's treasure trove. He failed in his mission to secure peace. At the same time, while he is off unaccounted for, Euron is on the Iron Island spilling out treasures full of gold and jewels and gems. It's an interesting coincidence, no? So next we get to the Kingsmoot. This is the Drowned Man chapter, which is the second Aeron chapter. It's a Feast for Crows chapter 20. Euron is present, of course, here, and we have eight chapters until, again, the Boiled Leather audio hour tells us that it's Dany's next chapter. In Daenerys, the fourth chapter, which is A Dance of Dragons 24, Dario returns to the city. At the end of the chapter, she sends the Stormcrows away again, and there's 10 chapters passing with no Euron or Dany from this point. Then we get to A Feast for Crow chapter 30, which is entitled The Reaver, which is the second Victarion chapter. Euron is now at the Shield Islands, and he's reaving. In Daenerys the Fifth, which is A Dance of Dragons chapter 31, I believe, Dany orders for the sellswords to be recalled to the city. She dreams of Dario dead by the road as crows quarreled over his corpse. The second sons return 8 days later, but the storm crows do not return. In Daenerys chapter 6, which is A Dance of Dragons chapter 37, six chapters later, Dario returns to the city, which is 17 chapters after she sent him away. So it's possible they could be the same person, but they'd have to have a ship capable of moving almost mystically fast. Fortunately, Martin has provided Euron with just that in the form of his infamous ship, the Silence, because again, that's a problem. He's got to go from Slaver's Bay to the Iron Islands, back to Slaver's Bay, back to the Iron Islands, back to Slaver's Bay in the course of two books. So he needs like the Millennium Falcon of pirate ships. Let's see what the books have to say about this.
The wind was at their beck, as it had been all the way down from Old Wyke. It was whispered about the fleet that Euron's wizards had much and more to do with it, that the Crow's Eye appeased the Storm God with blood sacrifice. How else would he have dared sail so far to the west instead of following the shoreline, as was the custom?
Now, it's interesting, and I actually found this out just before I recorded a podcast, and I didn't have time to pull. This is one of the last-minute tidbits. I didn't have time to pull the quotes, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest that Euron picks up four warlocks from Qarth in his voyages across the in Slaver's Bay and down in Essos. Dany also finds out from intelligence from Zarazon Duxos, who is still very much alive in the books, that Pyat Pree, which is the chief of the warlocks in the House of the Undying, has gone off with three other warlocks to come treat with her. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that Pyat Pree is now a slave warlock under the employ of Euron, and they're using blood magic to mystically make Euron's already fast and already infamous ship, the Silence, go even that much faster. In fact, the book notes that the Silence's deck is painted red to cover the blood, or to better hide the blood, rather, that's constantly covering it. So there's a lot of evidence here that he is using mystically fueled, super fast pirate ship that could essentially get him back and forth. Plus, he knows a way he can sail through the Doom of Valyria, which will cut off quite a bit of the trip, especially since we need him to be faster than Victarion to make some of these schemes go off. Now, the big question is why? Why would Euron pose as the sellsword in Essos? Now, obviously, Euron sees Dany's dragons as a key to conquering Westeros, and he's supremely confident that he will win Dany's hand in marriage. So confident that on the first read of the books, I thought he sounded like all the other Iron Islanders, which is to say he's a moronic blowhard. But if he is Daario, who has been very carefully grooming Dany to be a bloody, vengeful ruler, you know, he's always the Satan sitting on Dany's shoulder to Barristan Selmy and to Jorah's counsel of being a wise, benevolent ruler. He's always trying to get her to go to the fire and blood. If he's manipulating Victarion to fight the Battle of Meereen, to take the risk of blowing the magical dragon horn, which, by the way, is fatal to the wielder, and since he is the horn's true master, he's the one that found it, he's the one that's the king, Victarion is really just his patsy in this. If the horn is blown, the theory is that the dragons will actually be loyal to Euron, not the actual person physically blowing. This is starting to look fairly clever. Yes, it's kind of dense and hard to follow, and there's a lot of moving parts, but I can see why this would appeal to someone that is as crazy as Daario or Euron to pull off. So you can imagine when Dany finally comes riding back on Drogon, he'll be riding Viserion or maybe one of the other dragons with his blue fork beard, all like, "Hey, girl, how you like me now? What's up?" Now, again, there's a lot of cons of the theory. It's massive, it's a complicated plot that relies on all these moving parts and a heaping helping of warlock magic just to barely pull off. For another, it relies on the Stormcrows, a notoriously fickle band of sellswords with shifty loyalties, not caring that their leader, himself a notoriously fickle sellsword who has betrayed client and colleague alike, not giving two shits at their leaders off fucking around on secret missions to parts unknown. Simultaneously, it relies on Euron betting Dany and fucking around in Slaver's Bay when he just got done winning Kingsmute from a notoriously fickle and traitorous people, when you'd think he'd be concerned with consolidating his power back on the Iron Islands and ensuring that his people remain loyal. But as we've seen, there is a lot of evidence to support the theory. In fact, it's very eerie the way Martin has carved out these periods of time over the course of two simultaneously occurring books so the chronologies do not overlap. It's possible that's a coincidence. It's possible that the nods to book Daario and book Euron are embodied in show Daario. It's possible this is all a coincidence. It's possible that the showrunners are looking at some of these theories on the internet and just fucking with us. But there is much more there than initially meets the eye. And, you know, I think it's at least fun to theorize about and fun to think about, and I'm going to be adding this to my list of things I'm looking for very closely as we go on. How does show Daario behave, and how many more qualities of book Euron is he going to embody? Anyway, if you've enjoyed this theory, there's actually a video that I just found right before I recorded this podcast and doing some research that lays out this theory in about 16 minutes in a very visually compelling situation. It's a lot more interesting when you can see the two timelines laid out like he does in the video, and you can see the gaps matching up. I'll put a link to that because it's a YouTube link. I'll put a link to that in my show notes. If you are curious about this theory at all, I encourage you to take the time to watch that. If you got any other spoiler feedback for me, suggestions for tinfoil theories of your own, please send those in to gameofthrones@baldmove.com. Special thanks once again to our sponsor, Audible.com, for allowing us to use samples of their audiobooks to spice up our spoiler theory cast. Again, if you'd like to try a free sample, you can do so at audiblepodcast.com/GOT to get a free Audible book download. And we'll see you Sunday night for the instant take for episode 505, and Tuesday for the full cast, and next Friday for the next spoiler podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Aaron. See you later.